This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Professor's New Approach. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. First full weekend in March. Glad you could spend some time with us. And here's what's coming up during this program.
Faculty at some colleges are so worried about getting fired for offending a student that they're changing how they teach.
Interested in moonlighting as a small business owner? In addition to your full-time job, hear how a New Jersey teacher is doing it.
Two school districts in New Mexico have a way to recharge the batteries of sleepy students, let them nap in a high-tech pod.
And has the time arrived for a smartwatch to really wow the mass market?
For the watches, the one thing you would think they do really well, for instance, would be to tell time. But if you look at the Apple Watch, really that's not even its tertiary usage model. It's more like an iPod for your wrist. It didn't capture the excitement, and largely because it has to be tethered to an iPhone.
Tech analyst Rob Enderle on why the smartwatch may finally take off. He's here later in the hour. Well, there's no denying that President Trump has a unique set of issues to tackle, but there is not one singular issue that's dominating the American consciousness right now. Alicia Parlapiano, a graphics editor at the New York Times, has a deeper dive on how Americans, through the decades, have answered one simple question. What do you think is the most important problem facing this country today? Alicia, what were some of the findings?
You know, we talked to, you know, some of the people who work at the Gallup organization, and what they told us was that back through history, if there was a major war going on in the U.S., that was going to be the number one problem cited by Americans. If the economy was bad, that's going to be the number one issue cited by Americans. But if the economy is kind of humming along like it is right now, you know, for some people it's not, but for, you know, the overall numbers are, you know, things are fine and we're not engaged in a major war abroad. And so there's not kind of one consensus problem that Americans come around when those two are not, you know, at the forefront. And so people kind of choose their favorite domestic issue, and that's why there's kind of such a disparity in answers right now. You've got so many different ones because there's not one looming problem that Americans kind of all agree on right now.
Yeah. We're speaking with Alicia Parlapiano, a graphics editor at the New York Times. Her piece is called, What Do You Think is the Most Important Problem Facing This Country Today? And they've looked at just decades of information provided by respondents to this annual survey. Boy, just looking back 8 years to when President Obama first took office, how much a size of your graph was taken up by people saying economy in general.
Yep. The economy was, you know, it was kind of right in the middle of the Great Recession, and unemployment was going up, and people, you know, the financial crisis, and people were really worried about the economy. And so that was, you know, the largest share of answers by far.
Yeah. Well, and the graph that for today, for 2017, I think largely explains why President Trump was elected. These were issues he hit during the campaign.
Yep, absolutely. The biggest one right now, which it's relatively small compared to, you know, in past years when the economy or wars had taken up the biggest share of answers. But the number one answer right now is just dissatisfaction with government. Mm. You know, people unhappy with the way things are going in Washington. Trump obviously tapped into that during his campaign. Some other bigger issues, you know, immigration, civil rights and race relations, unifying the country, which is a common response right after an election, especially a highly contentious one like this one.
So
you can kind of see, like you said, a lot of the issues he brought up during the campaign reflected in what people say are the biggest problems.
Right. So, I mean, going all the way back to September 1935, was there a common theme here? Anything that was, you know, mostly noticeable throughout the decades?
You know, it like kind of like I said, you know, war and the economy are, you know, bubble up. And then And then you kind of see if you, there's a kind of a little hidden feature in this graphic where if you put your mouse over the month and the year for any chart, you can scroll through the data for every single poll that we have, not just the ones from, you know, the beginning of each presidential term. And so what you can see is that in addition to war and economy being major factors, people are really fickle and they change their minds pretty, you know, quickly.
Yeah,
there's a period during George H.W. Bush's presidency where drugs made up like two-thirds of responses for the biggest problem facing the country. You know, he was talking a lot about the war on drugs, but then quickly that issue kind of disappeared. And so you can see how we kind of maybe rally around a problem for a little while, and then it drops off and we find something else to worry about.
Thanks, Alicia. Alicia Parlapiano, graphics editor at The New York Times. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. College faculty across the country are adapting to an environment in which a word or turn of phrase, if perceived to be biased or insensitive, has the power to derail a career. Is this any way to teach? Perhaps more importantly, if you're a student, is this any way to learn? Here's Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Doug Belkin. Doug, what's up here?
Well, the idea is that there's a lot of students on campus who are quick to call out professors for saying something that is offensive to them. And so professors are watching what they say. And there's a lot of things that are structurally changing on universities that can essentially get professors in hot water if they're accused of saying something that's untoward.
Mm.
One of the big developments is these bias response teams that are made up of usually administrators. So if a student says a professor said something in class that made me uncomfortable or was racist or sexist or insensitive, they can go to one of these bias response teams and they'll ask questions and try to get to the bottom of it and look into whether or not the professor was indeed, you know, out of line. And if they are, then that can have potentially significant consequences for their career. So there's this there's a chill in the classroom that some professors speak to where they're concerned and anxious about what they say for fear of getting in trouble.
Goodness. Let me try to bring out both sides here. I mean, on one hand, are we talking about some thin-skinned, overly sensitive snowflakes here, or are there real concerns?
I think that the tone of what is acceptable and what was acceptable has shifted a lot in the past 20 years. You know, universities, it wasn't that long ago when universities were filled with white men and not much more. Universities, you know, it's not the case. They're very multicultural places now, and folks want to protect. Universities want to make their campuses places where students feel safe and comfortable. And the reality is kids learn better. They make more progress when they feel comfortable on the campus. There's a lot of research that back that up. But what defines making somebody uncomfortable, being biased, that's the gray area that universities are struggling to figure out.
Explain this this one guy you opened the story with, this Frank Tomasulo. What did he go through, this film studies guy?
So he's a good example, I think, of what's happening on campus. He's 70 years old now. He's been around for a long time. He's very accomplished university professor. He's led several departments at schools around the country, and he retired and then became an adjunct faculty member. And adjuncts, as an aside, I should say, have much fewer rights than tenured professors. They're much more vulnerable to being not having their contract renewed or being asked to leave. They just don't have any job protections. So in this capacity, he gave a lecture, and he asked, in the middle of a lecture, a young black woman was speaking. He asked her to be quiet. She refused, according to him. He asked her to leave. She refused. He called security. They escorted her out. And then he said something to the effect of, I hope that the rest of you folks in this class don't bring this attitude from the hood into our classroom. And this was just a code word and a dog whistle, and they got rid of him very quickly.
Wow.
Well, I should say they didn't. He resigned, but they were, I think, happy to see him go. They put a lot of pressure on him. So, you know, from his point of view, this was not a word that was racist from the perspective of the students sitting in class, especially the black students. It was clearly racist, and that that ended up being a big no-no for him. There's another woman in who teaches at a community college in California, in Simi Valley, which is a very conservative area. She teaches Western civilization. She has a lecture coming up she's been giving for a long time about fascism and nationalism, and she's very nervous because she says a lot of things around Trump that come to mind and parallels that can be brought, and she doesn't want to go there because she's afraid her students will accuse her of being biased, and that could cost her her job.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Doug Belkin. He's written a piece called College Faculty's New Focus, Don't Offend. I was surprised, too. You mentioned the one guy we talked about before, that Thomas Sulo. He doesn't even show the film Tootsie to students.
Yeah, his perspective is, I love to teach. I want to keep teaching. I want to be in front of the classroom. I don't want to deal with this anymore. So I'm going to avoid any hot button topics that are out there. So Birth of a Nation, which is a technical feat, was a real game changer in film, and deals with essentially supports the Ku Klux Klan. He doesn't show, even though it was sort of a turning point in film history. Tootsie brings up a lot of issues he's concerned about. He doesn't show that. There's a lot of things he just doesn't want to show because the conversations that follow unnerve him.
Wow. Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Doug Belkin can't even show Tootsie. It's 21 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Looking for a side business to put a little more money in your pocket? Using any available weekend time might be a place to start. That's partly how a New Jersey man launched his business called Caramia's Pizza. He cooks wood-fired brick oven pizza in your backyard or at your big event, typically on weekends, since he's a full-time teacher during the week. Here's his story about moonlighting as a small business owner. His name is Paul Poitras. Paul, how'd you do it?
Well, this all came about not planned at all. During college, I worked in a pizzeria. I started out driving, delivering, and I learned how to make pizza, and I learned how to work the ovens. And over time, I wound up managing the place, and I was the head pizza maker. So I learned a lot there. And then I bought a portable brick oven just for my backyard and to use with my family and just to make pizza for family events and for just having some friends over for casual parties. And it turned into one of my friends was asking me, hey, could you do this at my daughter's first birthday party? I said, sure, why not? So we wound up doing that, and it was very small, and it was not the production I have now. And it turned into Caramia's Pizza overnight.
Wow.
It was not planned at all.
Wow. Now, did you have some sort of cooking skills before you joined that pizzeria as a delivery guy in college?
Just casual stuff at home. I come from a big Italian family, so I always helped my mom and dad cooking and things like that, seeing what they do. I did most of the eating, but not a lot of the cooking, but I always helped.
Very good. So I'm curious, do the kids you teach in school demand stuff from you, say, on Fridays or for parties or something?
they always ask, and you know what? It's funny you say that because I always bring, if I always have extra dough at parties, I make some extra pizzas and put them in boxes, and I bring them in. And I also am a coach, so I coach wrestling, and we did a pizza party after the season was over, and I made some pizza for the kids. So, yeah, it was great. They always ask.
Oh, that's awesome. So your weekends really can be largely shot, right? I mean, you're teaching Monday through Friday, and I would imagine sometimes you get home and you kiss the family, and then you take off Friday night to some pizza-making gig, right? And not home till, I don't know, what, midnight or middle of the night Saturday.
Yeah, you know, Gordon, sometimes I have Friday parties or Saturday, Sunday parties. When I have two a weekend, yeah, it does get hairy. And plus, I have three kids, besides just doing the party, there's a lot of other things as far as, you know, making dough, shopping, prepping, and then cleanup. You know, cleanup is a two-hour process when I get home, so sometimes I even get home at midnight, and I'm washing dishes till 2 in the morning. So, yeah, it does get, you know, there's a lot involved.
Take us through some of the costs that you had to tackle, say, as you first launched this in terms of, you know, I don't know, products you needed for your brick oven pizza setup.
Yeah, you know what? Like I said, when I first did my first party, I had the bare minimum. And when I first was doing it, I was like, wow, I need this and this. And I just wrote a list, and the list was extensive in the beginning, And it came from there, and I was actually working out of my family minivan, and that was quickly put to rest by Mrs. Caramia's Pizza. And I had to buy a trailer and a pickup truck, and yeah, it did get costly in my first year, but yeah, we're ready to go for year two, and I'm really excited.
Oh, very good. So you've been around for, a full year at this point?
This is May will be one full year.
Wow.
That I did my first party. So yeah, it's taken off quite a bit in a year.
And explain the business model here, Paul. Do you charge like a single fee to come out, or do you charge by the pizza you make or by the hour? How do you do it?
So how I charge is I charge from 0 to 50 people is one rate. I give everyone one rate for that, and I service your full party. So if you have a party of 50 people, I always tell my customers that I will fully service your party. You don't need to do anything. A lot of the customers like to get a couple salads or apps or something like that, but that's not needed. But if you'd like to do that, that's totally fine. But I totally service your party. I bring enough, more than enough, to feed everybody at a party. So yeah, we go from. I've done parties from 10 people to I've done a backyard wedding where they had 110. So we're fully capable of doing the small end or the larger end of parties.
Thanks, Paul. Paul Poitras, full-time New Jersey teacher and owner of Caramia's Pizza. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Are you looking for a great wine at a great price? The solution is Cameron Hughes Wines. He's got a fascinating story. Cameron Hughes has relationships with these high-end wineries and producers all around the world, where he sources his wine and sells direct to you for much less than you'd pay under other labels. His wines deliver on price, value, and quality. Best price, best wine. Quality guaranteed. The best part is Cam guarantees all his wines. If you're unhappy with any bottle you buy from him, he'll make it right. Now, Cameron Hughes doesn't typically offer discounts because his prices are so much less than retail, but he's offering our listeners a fantastic deal on your first order of three or more bottles. Free shipping on that order and a sommelier-grade corkscrew. Only if you go to chwine.com and use my code DEAL. The only way to get free shipping and your free sommelier corkscrew, go to chwine.com. chwine.com. Shop for your wine. Enter my code DEAL at checkout. Don't wait. It's a limited time offer. This wine is fantastic. The deal is phenomenal. And I want you to go online and order it today. Again, chwine.com with the code DEAL. We're getting some first-ever health data for 500 of the biggest cities in America. It comes from a partnership involving the CDC and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It examines 27 chronic disease measures that focus on conditions, behaviors, and risk factors. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
It's called the 500 Cities Project, and it's designed with your health in mind. Dr. Judy Monroe, President and CEO of the CDC Foundation, is here to tell us what it is and what it's all about. Dr. Monroe, what is this website all about?
Yes, good morning. So this is an interactive website that for the 500 cities across the nation, every state will have at least one city represented, and this is data on health risk behaviors and chronic health conditions and use of preventive health services that drills down to actually the census tract level. It gets down to really that city level and down to the neighborhood level of what's happening with those health indicators. And this, the beauty of this is it gives policymakers and health commissioners, business owners, and even individuals the opportunity to go out onto the site and drill down and take a look at the community you live in to see what the health conditions look like.
Where's this data coming from?
So this is data that CDC since 1984 has had the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. This is gathering data, again, in all 50 states and D.C. Through telephone interviews on these risk behaviors and chronic health conditions and the use of preventive services. And what they've done is use a new methodology. This is a methodology that generates small area estimation of the measures. It's a multi-level statistical modeling framework, and there's a lot behind that. So folks interested in that methodology can go on to CDC's website and read papers on how they've done this. But they're using that data from the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System to drill down to this local level data.
We're speaking with Dr. Judy Munro of the CDC Foundation about a new website where you can get information about health in your particular neighborhood. Let's break this down a little further. If you want to find out something about your city or your neighborhood and you look at this website, what are you looking for? What do you see?
Yeah, so what's going to happen if you can go to your city, and if your city is one of the 500 cities, you will find now this interactive map that you can enlarge and then begin to see for each of 27 chronic conditions how each of those census tracts are looking. So, example, you might take a look at smoking as an indicator, and you're going to find in a lot of these cities, and I think what's so remarkable about this is how variable the rates of smoking or obesity or alcohol use as examples, how variable that is even within city limits when you begin to look at that neighborhood level. So you'll find, depending on where you live, you may find that there are some neighborhoods that you have smoking rates, you know, closing in on 29-30%, and yet a mile from there you might have smoking rates of 10 or 11%. So it's quite variable, and the beauty of that then is that if you have limited resources or your city planners, health officers, business owners, and so forth, can begin to target the use of resources so that you know where the biggest problem is with whatever you're trying to accomplish, and you can really target those resources.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Dr. Judy Munro, President and CEO of the CDC Foundation. Again, the data can be found at cdc.gov/500 cities. It's 21 minutes in front of the hour on This Weekend. Time now for a tech update. Is the smartwatch ready for a breakout year? Tech analyst Rob Enderle says until this point, it's pretty clear why this class of product is languishing. The key teachings from Steve Jobs at Apple have been forgotten. But with products like the LG Watch Sport, the market may finally be coming around to a winner. Rob, what did you look at?
Well, what we really had with regard to the smartwatch is a painful experience. So we've no real iPod moment for the watches. The one thing you would think they do really well, for instance, would be to tell time. But if you look at the Apple Watch, really that's not even its tertiary usage model. It's more like an iPod for your wrist
right.
In terms of how it's implemented. So it didn't capture the excitement, and largely because it has to be tethered to an iPhone. So to get full capability, you need your phone close by. You can't have it by itself. And it only works with iPhone. If you have an Android phone, it won't work. But this new generation of smartwatches that are coming to market outside of Apple are disconnected. So in other words, you don't have to connect it to any phone. They connect back to the WAN network. They do tell time very well, but they also do everything that they want to do without having to have your phone nearby. And the end result is it's much more of a useful product, a product that comes closer to what the iPod was.
Mm. All right, so you mentioned the LG Watch Sport. Explain kind of what this thing does differently from, say, the Apple Watch.
So the LG Watch Sport is tied. You can use it with either an iPhone or an Android phone, or you don't need either one. It's got a WAN connection built in, so if you leave your phone at home, it still fully functions. It connects to the same cellular network that your phone connects to. In fact, with AT&T, it uses the same phone number your phone uses. So even if you've left your phone at home and you're out running, you can still get cell phone calls on the watch. And so that's part of what does it. It's tracking your activity real time, and it's always connected, so it's always updating. So unlike a Fitbit, where if you run and you leave your phone at home, it still has to sync up.
Right.
To tell folks what it is you're doing. This thing's connected while you're running, and so it keeps folks up to date with what you're doing. And by the way, given the increased instance of folks having heart problems while running, that's probably an important feature in and of itself, because in theory it can alert out if you get into trouble, where a Fitbit can't unless you brought your phone along with you. And it does things like it'll play music, it'll stream music, so all the things that you would want an iPod to do, for instance, if you were still carrying an iPod, this watch will do even if you've left your phone at home. And that's really the big difference here. It does everything all by itself. You don't even necessarily need to have a phone, though it's limited functionality. You're probably going to miss the phone if you don't have one altogether.
Okay.
But you certainly don't need to carry it with you, and the watch is fully capable as a standalone device, regardless of whether you've got an Apple phone, a Google phone, a Microsoft phone, or an old flip phone that has no internet connectivity. The watch works fine.
Wow. We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and president of the Enderle Group, the tech advisory firm. He's written a piece called Why the Smartwatch May Finally Take Off or Not. So what are the limits of this the LG watch sport? You touched on it a little bit, but what else is there?
Well, you still have to market the device. I mean, one of the things that made the iPod very successful is that Apple put a lot of marketing dollars behind it. Steve Jobs personally took it on as a project product. They built advocacy for it. I was one of the first folks to get an iPod, so I remember having Steve Jobs hand me my first iPod along with all the CDs for the music that they put on it and make sure it was legal. It took that kind of an effort to build the initial wave that had eventually resulted in success. And clearly with the Apple Watch, they tried to do that. It was the wrong product. LG doesn't seem to have that DNA. And so the end result is, even though the product is capable of breaking out, the effort behind it to convince people this is really something different isn't there. And so people like to look at an LG watch in an AT&T store and figure it's really no different than anything else that's out there, even though it is a sleek, standalone product.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, president and principal of the Enderle Group, the tech advisory firm. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Transition seamlessly from presentation to meeting and from work to home with the Dell Latitude 13 7000 series, the laptop that takes care of business. The powerful performance and incredible battery life from this reliable business-class PC featuring Intel Core processors lets small business employees do their best work wherever work takes them. Learn more at dell.com/radio. That's dell.com/radio. Many residents of North Dakota consider free parking in a downtown area a birthright, but state lawmakers may soon allow towns to install parking meters. What's happening? Wall Street Journal reporter James Haggerty paid a visit to Grand Forks. James, what'd you find?
Well, a lot of people think of North Dakota as a place where it'd be pretty easy to park. We've got fewer than 10 people per square mile, and a lot of wide open spaces. And in fact, parking meters have been banned from the streets of North Dakota since 1949. But that now is under question because the legislature is considering a bill that would let parking meters come back.
Wow. All right. So as you point out, I think there are a couple of folks who said this is not really about revenue. What's it about?
Well, there are a few modest-sized towns, small cities in North Dakota that have downtown areas that can get a bit congested at times, people going to shops and restaurants. And the problem is that sometimes the people who work downtown will hog all the best parking spaces, and that can make it harder for the paying customers to get the ideal parking space. So a few of the mayors would like to have the ability to have parking meters so they could ration space more rationally.
Holy cow. There are just, I guess, few spaces to be had, and that's why it appears that they're all being hogged by the downtown workers?
The prime spaces, yeah.
Yeah. Jeez. So if the state legislature goes through with this, how many towns wind up jumping on the opportunity to install these things?
Well, I would say 3 or 4 or 5 maybe. They might not jump, though, because I think they'll still be a little bit hesitant. They'll have to weigh the possible political blowback from residents,
right.
So they might go cautiously in.
And who's to say downtown workers just won't get there just as early and put money in the meters?
That's true. But they'll have to pay the price, yeah.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter James Haggerty. He's written a piece called, "You Know What North Dakota Needs? More Parking Meters." So as you point out, this was a law came through in 1949 that prohibited parking meters.
That's and right. There was a farmer way up by the Canadian border named Howard Henry, and he used to drive down 60 miles south to Minot every now and then to buy supplies, and he thought that the merchants of Minot should be pretty grateful for his business, but instead he was having to pay a nickel to park. And one day after getting a parking ticket, he got so enraged that he decided to lead a initiative drive and put the question on the ballot of whether parking meters could be used in North Dakota, and he won.
Wow.
And nobody has been able to overturn that since.
Thanks, James. Wall Street Journal reporter James Haggerty, who paid a visit to North Dakota. It's 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. If you think that high school kids are a bunch of softies these days, this story will not improve your impression of them. Four high schools in New Mexico are using high-tech sleep pods for students who may not have gotten a full night's sleep. USA Today says the sleep pods made by MetroNaps include a reclined chair with a domed sensory reduction bubble that closes around your head and torso. The pods generally feature a one-touch start button that activates a relaxing sequence of music and soothing lights. Some even have headphones. At the end of 20 minutes, the pod begins to vibrate gently, and an up-tempo beat gradually starts playing to wake the student. A school nurse says students were coming to school exhausted, so staff would put them in the pod. Within 20 minutes, they were coming out refreshed and focused. It worked for kids who had anxiety, even those who were anxious test takers. Guess who else benefited? Stressed out teachers. The Las Cruces and Gadsden school districts in New Mexico are the only ones in the country using the pods. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.